Welcome to Diffuse Congruence. This is episode 34 of the American Muslim Experience. My name is Zaki Hassan, and with me once again is my co-host, Pervez Ahmed.
Hey, welcome everyone. Thanks for joining us again. It's been a minute. Very excited to have with us Dr. Ingrid Mattson. Was educated in Canada and in the United States, earning her PhD from the University of Chicago in 1999. From 1998 to 2012, she was professor of Islamic studies at the Hartford Seminary, where she also developed and directed the first accredited graduate program for Muslim chaplains. Really love to talk about that, and served as the director of the McDonald Center for the Study of Islam and Christian-Muslim Relations. Then from 2001 to 2010, Dr. Mattson served as vice president and then later as president of the Islamic Society of North America, ISNA, the first woman to serve in that position. Her writings, both academic and public, focus primarily on Quran interpretation, Islamic theological ethics, and interfaith relations. She is presently senior fellow of the Royal Ahlul Bayt Institute of Islamic Thought in Amman, Jordan. And we're really excited to have you join us, Professor Mattson. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Excellent. And you join us now. Presently, you are on faculty at
Huron University College in London, Ontario. It's part of the campus of Western University in London.
Correct. So that is that sort of a return back to Canada? Because I take it you're originally from Canada?
It is. It is. I lived over 20 years in the United States, and I come pretty much every month. So I'm an Americanized Canadian, you could say, but it's a good time to be back in Canada, frankly.
You want to definitely get into some of that a little later. So tell us a little bit about your sort of early childhood. You were born and raised, I guess, spent your early life in Canada. What part of Canada?
Right. So I grew up in Southern Ontario. In a place called Kitchener, Ontario, which mostly Sudanese know, since Lord Kitchener was the viceroy of England in Sudan, a very unpleasant character. So that's a kind of embarrassing name to have of my native city. Grew up a big family. Had a wonderful childhood, Catholic education, elementary school, high school. Then I went on to study philosophy and fine arts at the University of Waterloo. All of that before I came to the United States.
Correct. So was it while you were in your undergraduate studies that you sort of first Islam kind of comes across your radar and kind of piques your interest?
Yeah, well, I was raised Roman Catholic, but mm-hmm. I left that tradition when I was 15 years old, and then subsequently had no religious identity or affiliation, wasn't any kind of seeker, wasn't really interested. I just kind of walked away from it and didn't think about it anymore. But then I met some Muslims from West Africa when I was studying in France during my undergraduate education. They were, as far as I knew, the first Muslims I met. A lot of fun, beautiful, wonderful people. Not, you know, strictly observant, but just wonderful people. And they were because they were the first Muslims I met, they really set the example for me of just a good, ordinary Muslim, and I was interested in their background, their culture. I didn't know anything about it, so that's when I started reading up about Islam.
And does that sort of take you, or why you decide to sort of study it beyond the undergraduate level? I know you do your master's and PhD in Islamic studies at the University of Chicago.
Well, what happened is, to my surprise, as I was reading about Islam, simply to learn more about my friends uh-huh. who were from Senegal, and so I was also reading West African literature and about their history and culture. But when I started reading, what I learned was their sacred book, the Quran, I, to my surprise, found myself really having a very deep and compelling spiritual experience where I was reconnecting with God through this book. So I became a Muslim then at the end of my undergraduate education, and that really changed everything because I had been all set to continue with school. Probably I would have gone on to do an art history degree. Mm. But I became a Muslim and started hearing a lot of strange things from other Muslims about what that meant now. You know, there's a kind of, I call it bait and switch process, where when you're learning about Islam, you're just given the simple and the easy and the beautiful stuff. And then once you become a Muslim, all of these different Muslims and Muslim groups are trying to force their agenda, their ideology, their school of thought on you.
Right.
And it was not a very pleasant experience, but I was very fortunate that I went to the University of Toronto bookstore looking for some books on Islam to make a bit of sense on it. And I found Fazlur Rahman's book, Islam. And I read it. I was blown away.
Right.
And that was it. I said, I have to study with this man.
Mm. That's remarkable. You know, in the past, we've had several of our guests in the past mentioned Dr. or some connection to Dr. Fazlur Rahman, certainly directly Dr. Omar studying with him and doing his PhD with him at the University of Chicago, but also some of our other guests as well. So I think, if anything, our listeners have sort of taken away those who aren't familiar with or haven't been introduced to the writings of Professor Fazlur Rahman. Hopefully they do so.
The strange thing, though, is, you know, I wrote him a letter. This is, of course, in the days before the internet and email.
Yeah.
I wrote him a letter saying I wanted to study with him. He wrote me back. I still have that letter. I have it right on my bookshelf beside my desk at home. He wrote back to me inviting me to come study with him.
Beautiful.
And it was just so exciting. But then I had a little thing I had to do before going to graduate school, which is I had always wanted to do some relief or development work. So I went and I did that for 2 years before I went to Chicago. In the meantime, he had passed away. So I arrived at Chicago without Fazlur Rahman, but surrounded by his students and his legacy. And that was a very important lesson for me spiritually. And also, you know, I felt that although I felt a little bit orphaned at that point, looking back on it, I think it was in many ways good for me. And of course, he was a great scholar who left all of his books,
right,
as well as his students and those who mentored him. So we have that, you know, access to that community of knowledge, which is wonderful.
Right. So then you arrive in Chicago. I just based on the time frame, we're talking early 80s, because I think he passes away in 1981, I believe, right?
No, I'm not that old.
Oh, okay.
I arrived there in 1989, and he had died the year before.
Oh, that's right, 88. I'm sorry. Yeah. Right. So then you're there, and so by then, of course, Dr. Omar had already graduated. He was already done.
Right, but Dr. Ahmed was this, he was kind of a mythical figure among us. Everyone read his multi-volume, monumental doctoral dissertation.
Yeah.
Sitting in the library, we used to fight for that. And we talked about him all the time. Everyone would be saying, well, where is he now? What's he doing? How could we access him? And he was just such a topic of conversation. We were so intrigued because he was clearly such a genius, and his ideas were so compelling. So a number of years later, after I arrived at Chicago, I had the great pleasure of being approached by some people in Chicago who had met Dr. Ahmed in Europe or in England and wanted to find a way to get him back to America and sponsor him through some kind of organization. And that was the development of the Nowy Foundation. So when I heard his name and I was approached to see if I wanted to support this effort, I was simply overjoyed. And it was such an honor to be able to be involved with Nowy and have that chance to spend time with Dr. Ahmed for a number of years in Chicago.
That's right. You served as you were on the board of directors, I believe, at Nowy Foundation.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's right. And I think a connection to Zeki is that his wife went on the trip with you and Dr. Armour and Dr. Jackson to China.
In 2002.
Yeah, those were the best trips. I mean, trips of they were extraordinary for all of us. We had Dr. Ahmed, Sherman Jackson, Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad. Timothy Winter was with us on some of those trips. I don't remember if he was on the China trip.
Not China, but China. Yeah, China was just the three of you. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So I mean, it's just such a blessed company.
Right.
You know, for all of us, because we had very often when, I mean, each one of us, when we go someplace to teach or lecture, it's often just work and a kind of teacher-student relationship. But here we were traveling together as scholars and teachers. Certainly, I wouldn't consider myself a peer of Dr. Ahmed. So I had the chance to learn from him as I was teaching as well. It's just a really blessed time.
Right, right. I'd love to talk to you a little bit about that. But I think we're going back to your experiences at the University of Chicago. You focus your research and writings on the Quran. I believe your dissertation had to do with the Quran, correct?
No, actually, it wasn't. My dissertation was on slavery and social status in early Islamic society and law.
That's
so
right.
my dissertation is called "A Believer is Better Than an Unbeliever," which is taken from the Quran, a verse of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at this issue of slavery and social status and trying to understand why, if the Quran and the Sunnah were clearly in the direction, you know, what Fazl Rahman would call the kind of moral thrust of the Quran and the Sunnah was in the direction of equality and freedom, human freedom, why did slavery continue to exist until the 19th century in the Muslim world, and why were many Muslim societies plagued by a hierarchical kind of division that affected people's mobility and really the idea of human equality. So I think what I always advise people who are going to undertake a doctoral study is that the only way you can really get through it, because it's so grueling, it's so isolating, it's just such a difficult thing to do, is that you have to have an issue that you just need to solve. You know, you have a question that is so compelling to you that you cannot sleep or eat until you get it, until you tackle this, and you keep, it just keeps gnawing at you. And for me, it was that issue. And so it was challenging, but it was also satisfying to be able to devote that amount of time to that topic.
Yeah. So did you, I mean, what was the sort of resolution to that in your mind in terms of the way that, you know, you approached the topic and then, you know, the research you explored?
Well, I'll tell you, I went into my study, you know, really committing myself to honesty. I said, look, I have some core beliefs. I believe in God. I believe the Quran's the word of God. I believe that Muhammad, peace be upon him, is a messenger of God. After that, I could accept that anyone else could be infallible, you know, is infallible, and that anyone else, any other Muslim, can make a mistake and has made many mistakes. So I think this is part of the advantage of not growing up Muslim, is I didn't have this kind of Muslim identity issue. Islam wasn't an identity to me. I didn't link my self-esteem or my religious identity to the idea of a glorious Islamic civilization. I just didn't have all that baggage. So I think it made me able to really freely and honestly look at Islamic history in all of its beauty and ugliness, where it was. And what I mean, and I guess the short answer to what I discovered is that, and I think I was guided in this by Michel Foucault, who I studied also as an undergraduate in my studies of philosophy, right, is that it wasn't about identifying the person or a few people who were evil or who created some kind of negative energy for Islamic society to go off the rails this way. It wasn't as bad as I thought. It was a question of understanding structures and understanding how there are unintended consequences of structures, but also how knowledge really is related to power. And it's important to understand that the scholarly class in Islamic civilization were extraordinary people. I mean, in the end, you really admire their dedication, but like all people, they also have interests. And they certainly had a corporate interest in maintaining the scholarly class, because really for them and in their mind and in reality, I think, they were the only thing between the ordinary people and tyranny. I mean, they had this, they had a kind of independence that they were insistent on maintaining.
Right.
But that's a compromise with power. It means that they accept that political power is responsible for some things, and they can only be responsible for other things. So in terms of moral guidance, they were extraordinary. In terms of upholding the law, they did uphold it on an individual basis, but they had no ability to address systemic problems. And something like slavery is a systemic problem. It can't be dealt with piecemeal. They were constantly encouraging the good treatment of slaves, the liberation of slaves, their emancipation. Their judgments generally were very good and really were in keeping with the spirit of treating these people primarily as human beings who had fallen into this terrible state of slavery, with the hope that, like every human being, they would one day be free again. So there wasn't this sense that there's a certain class of people who should be slaves or who are essentially slaves. No, they were human beings. Right. But they had no way of addressing the systemic problem. Mm-hmm. And even some of their solutions probably didn't help to move the system towards a dismantling. So it's quite complicated, but it shows us that none of these problems of human dignity can be dealt with in a very simplistic way. They're complicated and have many angles, economic, political.
Right. Right. I think, yeah, I mean, there's so much like that you uncover there. But the idea of, the sort of scholarly class being the buffer, if you will, between the ordinary people and the state, I think that might come as a surprise to not only maybe our non-Muslim audience and listeners, but also our Muslim listeners, because oftentimes, you know, the way we've constructed or the way Islamic civilization is often viewed is as this sort of, you know, theocracy where the scholarly class and the state were in cahoots, and that's just Islamic history or Muslim history just doesn't play out that way, where in fact the scholarly class really saw themselves and maintained themselves in conscious opposition to the state.
Well, unfortunately, the situation changed during modernity.
Right.
And that's why, I mean, of course, we all believe that this is the case, because this is how it's been for about maybe less than 200 years, but certainly over 100 years with the modern nation state.
Correct.
And people like Wa'al Halaq have demonstrated this very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Wa'al Halaq was at Columbia. Professor of the history of Islamic law and legal theory, has done a lot of research in this area and shows that we moved from, you know, a pre-modern empires and sultanates and other forms of territorial authority that were quite limited in their reach. I mean, they wanted law and order, but their means of exerting law and order were pre-modern, so were limited. But they also, for them, what law and order meant and what Sharia meant in most cases was just maintaining peace among people and the local norms and the local traditions and the means of resolving conflict were the first choice. You know, it wasn't this kind of top-down authoritarian state. I mean, there was no such thing as a ministry of endowments and religious affairs. In fact, the endowments for religious institutions and educational institutions were independent, and that's what allowed their independence. It's when they were nationalized by these modern nation states that governments took almost totalitarian control of religion.
Right, right, exactly. I was speaking more about the sort of pre-modern era, like you mentioned. But I think also kind of worth noting, perhaps, that, you know, the institution of slavery wasn't racialized like it was in sort of certainly the American context when we see slavery in Muslim history.
Well, there was, I mean, certainly slavery wasn't considered to be the divine state of some group of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
All human beings were considered to be essentially free, which right. is why if there was a foundling, for example, an abandoned baby, their legal status was always free, never slave, because freedom is the original status of any human being, no matter what their color is.
Mm.
So slavery was, at least theoretically or conceptually, was the product of war.
Right.
War where you had, you know, far too many captives to do anything else with them unless they all would be executed, which is seem much less humane than taking them as captives. Now, you know, this is not to be apologetic for slavery in any, you know, by any means. It's just that there weren't a lot of choices for pre-modern people. That we have more choices now in warfare because we have the technology to be able to detain and hold a couple thousand people in one place and feed them and water them and not have them, you know, end up with cholera. You need to take their sewage away.
Right.
But even now, we still have some problems. I mean, there are a lot of people who are detained or confined in semi-penal systems who are not being well-maintained and whose legal status is liminal because it's always a challenge. Well, you know, what do you do with the enemy when they still want to fight you? You know, who do you release them to? How do you release them without hurting yourself or having them just come back and attack others? By the way, this is one of the reasons why my favorite TV show is The Walking Dead, because they're precisely dealing with this issue in this season about a determined enemy. And if you know they're coming back to get you, what can you do with them? Do you kill them or do you confine them? What's moral in that situation? It's very difficult.
Well, and can you talk some more about your own journey in terms of moving past your PhD into the Hartford Seminary? What took you there and what you got out of that?
Well, I as a graduate student, I was always in touch with ordinary life, ordinary communities. I had a family, I had children and a husband, and so we wanted to be part of Muslim communities and life, to have that religious life and to enjoy holidays and other things with them. So I never was just sitting in the library, although I spent most of my time there. But I was in communities too, and I knew that while my dissertation research was really focused on a topic in legal theory and history and Islamic history and society, that I always, my questions were always oriented towards how do we, in the background, how could this help us understand what we're supposed to do today as Muslims? So I'd always been interested in living Muslim communities and been involved in part of them. So while I was finishing up my dissertation, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do. I knew that I was supposed to start applying for academic jobs. I wasn't feeling that enthusiastic about it, but I would have gone ahead and done it if I had not received a call. I mean, literally a phone call from someone, a friend of mine, who I studied with at the University of Chicago. She's a well-known professor of Islamic studies, Marian Katz. And she called me. At that time, she was teaching at Mount Holyoke, I believe, and said, Ingrid, there's this job that I heard about that I think you would be perfect for. I know people on the search committee, they asked me if I knew anyone, would you be interested in it? And then she described this job at Hartford Seminary, which I knew of only because of the Muslim World Journal. Hartford Seminary publishes the oldest English language journal dedicated to Islamic studies and Christian Muslim relations. Wow. So I knew that name, but I didn't know much else about it. And they were looking for a Muslim professor who would be involved in some form of professional religious leadership training and education for Muslims. So it was, I was curious, and they said, can you meet us next week? They were kind of at the end of their search, and it seems they hadn't quite found the person they wanted. So I said, okay. I went, met them, saw what they were doing, and was really enthusiastic about it. And that's how I arrived in Hartford, Connecticut, with the mission to develop some kind of religious leadership program for Muslims.
Well, and in terms of your own journey now, you served as a president of ISNA from 2006 to 2010, and that was certainly at a time where the profile of anti-Muslim figures had increased, although it seems lower then than it does now. I mean, now it's almost become acceptable and mainstream. I would love to get your perspective on how things have changed in terms of how Islam and Muslims are talked about and discussed in the public sphere, which is something that you were dealing with, on the front lines of, so to speak.
Yeah, I spent 10 years pretty much dealing with this issue. I was elected, so I went to Hartford Seminary in 1999, and then I was elected vice president of ISNA in 2001, started that, took that responsibility a week before September 11th.
Okay, I was going to ask.
So what I had thought was going to be, you know, a standard kind of board position of a Muslim organization. It's a volunteer position where I would be going to, you know, having a meeting, a board meeting once a month and going to some activities, suddenly became something else. The demand for Muslim voices, for education on Islam, both for Muslims and for non-Muslims, was so critical, because on the one hand, we had these violent extremists justifying their actions in the name of Islam, which was very confusing to many Muslims. And on the other hand, you know, there were people who were already ideologically hostile to Muslims, either for political reasons or religious reasons, or maybe just racial, because Islam is racialized. So they were, you know, white supremacists or others who saw this as an opportunity to really hammer Muslims and Islam. And, you know, if that sounds exaggerated, it isn't, because right away I was reading their newsletters, publications. I remember getting, I must have been, maybe because I was had a subscription to something like The Nation or Mother Jones or something like that. I remember getting letters, solicitation letters for membership from atheist organizations saying, this is the time now to attack Islam because it's weak and we can really show how terrible religion is.
Wow.
Yeah, so that has only increased, and unfortunately, we have this, you know, what is very clearly a mirroring process where the extremists on both sides simply reflect each other and reflect each other's violence and bigotry and xenophobia, and are looking for political and military ways of hurting the other side. So it's been, you know, it's very disheartening to see this, and we're living in such a violent time, and such a time of vulgarity and meanness and deliberate misinformation and misunderstanding. And the thing that has made this so much worse is that really the rise in the internet and the widespread availability of the internet coincided with this.
Right.
So before, where someone, you know, the only place they may have learned about Islam or heard about Islam is they might get a little snippet of the news and read about it and feel confused. And if they were really motivated, maybe they'd go to the public library and look up something. Now all they have to do is open their computer, Google it, and they would see all of these Islamophobic, websites would come up with misinformation. So it is just, it is very difficult to crack into, you know, that Islamophobic tangled web of misinformation. At the same time, there's the other tangled web of violent extremists misinformation about Islam.
That's right.
So it means that you know, there's no one naive anymore. There are no naive encounters. When I first started public speaking in the late 90s, I would go to a church group or a community group, and they might have some impression of Islam and Muslims, maybe vaguely negative if they were aware of Middle East politics, maybe somewhat positive if they had a neighbor or someone they worked with who was a nice Muslim. But they were open to learning or listening. By the mid-2000s, it was a completely different dynamic. You know, I'd be invited to speak to a group, and immediately, you know, in the question period, people would be asking, you know, throwing out all these terms. Well, what about jihad? Right. What about, and of course, taqiyya? How could we trust you? We know that Muslims are supposed to lie about their religion. they would say, so I can't even trust what you're saying. Or they would say, well, you seem like a nice person, but it must be because, you know, you're a Westerner, or you're not really like the rest of Muslims. So the dynamic is completely different.
Right.
Well, and to that point, I mean, there might be people listening here who don't understand what taqiyya is, or who've heard it and don't have a context for it. Maybe this is a good time to explain what that is exactly.
Right. So what it means is dissimulation or kind of hiding something. And the Islamophobes have made it into some kind of article of faith of Islam, which it is not whatsoever. Muslims are required by the Quran to be honest, to be trustworthy. The Prophet Muhammad said that a believer cannot be a liar. So lying is absolutely forbidden. Breaking your oath are forbidden. All of these things. This is a very strong, strong principle that pervades the Quran and the Sunnah. It is true, however, that if someone is if their faith is, if their life is under threat, if they are subject to torture, persecution that they cannot bear, that they could conceal their religion. So this came out of the time when early Muslims were being persecuted, and in particular, the verse of the Quran that talks about the person who's not held accountable for denouncing their faith, if they're under duress, is a young man, Ammar, who was tortured along with his parents, Yasir and Sumaya, in Mecca, for being Muslim, and they were slaves. His parents were slaves, and the three of them were tortured. His mother was sexually violated in the torture and killed, so they were both murdered in front of his eyes. And so he, as a young man, then said, okay, I'll say whatever you want me to say. Mm-hmm. He felt very bad. He felt that when they let him go after this, he felt that he had lost his soul. And when he came to the Prophet Muhammad, devastated, the Prophet Muhammad's, who had no way of protecting him at this time, he had no means of protection, he had no political authority, said to him, if they come for you again, say the same thing. Meaning that you're not supposed to, you know, you don't have to allow yourself to be tortured to death when God knows what's in your heart. And then Muslims use this exemption again during the time of the Inquisition after the Reconquista of Ferdinand and Isabella in Spain. And they were persecuting and torturing people who had Muslim and Jewish backgrounds, by the way, right. Trying to see if they were true Christians or true Catholics, and because you had to either be Catholic or leave, and many people didn't want to leave their home, and they were hoping that somehow they would be allowed religious freedom again in the future. So they went along and pretended they were Catholic, but they were subject to the Inquisition, and many were tortured, of course, to death and burnt to death. But this was brought in as an exemption, and that really set the theme in, you know, the Catholic Spain of Ferdinand and Isabella is the first, many scholars would say, the first fascist state, the first fascist modern nation state.
Wow.
And it was this totalitarian controlling state. But it set also the tone for pre-modern Europe of what a Muslim is. So it was really this idea that Muslims are sneaky people who they pretend to be, you know, they tend to be good Christians, but they're really Muslims underneath. So if we look historically, we see that idea of the deceptive Muslim continuing, and by the way, also the deceptive Jew. So this is a very common trope of anti-Semitism, European anti-Semitism, is that the Jew is hiding his true intentions, that he's plotting to, you know, overthrow Western civilization or Christian civilization, etc. So Muslims and Jews have shared this this idea of being untrustworthy in the anti-Semitic and Islamophobic rhetoric of European civilization.
Well, and I mean, in terms of your own experience, you know, the 10 years that you were doing this work with ISNA, I mean, from what you're describing, it was a disheartening experience. Would that be an accurate description?
Certainly it was disheartening in that way. On the other hand, there were wonderful, great, tremendous things that happened. And we have to remember that the Holy Quran says, maybe you hate something and it's good for you.
Sure.
So in the sense that it was tremendously hard, but it also brought the best out in the best people. And I saw that among Muslims and among people of other faiths and no faiths. So we saw that as this was happening, first and foremost, and this is important, that Muslims, ordinary Muslims, were standing up for true Islam, the true voice of Islam against the extremists. So I was just flooded with requests from ordinary Muslims and communities for education. I had this influx of students at Hartford Seminary, of ordinary Muslims, some retired Muslims who came out of retirement, or women who up until that time were just in the mosque serving some, you know, tea and biryani, or, you know, on potluck nights, who said, I can no longer let these extremists speak for me. I need to learn more about my religion. And they came and they did degrees and they studied, and then they went out and they, you know, developed the strong voice. And all over America, we saw that, you know, with things like ING, the Islamic Networks Group, which is a wonderful speakers bureau organization. They saw this huge increase in demand among Muslims to learn more about Islam and be able to articulate, first and foremost, to themselves, to their families, to their communities, what is the true message that is pluralistic, that it is supportive of democracy, loyalty, all of these things. So to me, it stimulated this incredible growth, intellectual maturity, spiritual maturity, and a sense of responsibility among American Muslims that, you know, no one else is going to do this for us. We need to get a grip and articulate our own vision of Islam and establish institutions that are going to reflect those values. So we also saw this tremendous growth in new kinds of Islamic organizations, from, you know, doing social justice and medical free clinics, and all of these efforts that were just really that show what Islam is really about. And at the same time, again and again and again, we saw leaders of the Jewish community, of the of different Christian denominations, of secular people in civil rights organizations and social justice organizations stand up and say, we want to be partners with you in this good work. We want to amplify your message. We want to be loudspeakers for you to our communities and our religious congregations about what Islam is and what Muslims are, because we don't want, you know, we don't want our people to be biased and bigoted towards Muslims. And so that gives me tremendous encouragement. I think we're far better than we ever were before in terms of our own knowledge, our maturity in taking responsibility for our community, and in having really principled partnerships with our allies. So it's not only about us, but the Quran says, "Ham jazaa al ihsan ila al ihsan," is a reward for goodness other than goodness. And so Muslims are also reciprocating, advocating for the rights of other people, not just for their own rights in this context. So all of that is tremendously encouraging, and is the lesson for us about the good that can come out of a bad situation.
Right. Right.
I agreed, and I think. Yeah, I mean, to have you sort of see that from the vantage point of your leadership role at ISNA, because, I mean, really, if you look at the time period there, I mean, that's really where you see, like you said, the sort of expansive nature of Muslim community, or of the Muslim community sort of responding to, but at the same time going well beyond, you know, what was happening, you know, post 9/11. So I think that's very, very fascinating. If I could maybe shift the discussion a little bit in the time that we have left, to sort of maybe within the Muslim community and going back perhaps a little bit to your work at Hartford, at the Hartford Seminary, with regards to the chaplaincy program. You know, I'd love for you to sort of comment on what you see as the needs that we have as a Muslim community in terms of, like, because, I mean, you know, it's one thing to have a qualified imam, per se, who is, say, you know, a scholar in his or her own right, you know, has the requisite training in scripture and so on, but not having this sort of training and background in pastoral care, which, you know, when I think of a chaplaincy program, that's really what I think of. So I'd love for you to sort of talk about that a little bit in terms of the needs of the Muslim community in having leadership who is not only trained academically, you know, as a scholar or in the Islamic sciences, but also really, you know, this need to be able to deliver pastoral care to the growing community.
This is such an urgent need. It's not only pastoral care, it's individual counseling. It is care for people where they are in society, whether that's in the mosque, in a hospital, in a prison, on the streets, or confined to their home. Mm-hmm. What is the point of community? I mean, I really think we need to step back and say, what is a jama'ah? What is a congregation? What does it mean? Why do we even come together for community? Of course, we need to find some place where we can get together to pray in congregation. All right, check. We have that. We need to learn what is necessary for a religion. But in the end, you know, this is, we have to, I think it would be helpful for American Muslims to think, and really Muslims globally, to think again about the kind of congruence between political systems and social systems. So because political systems in the Muslim world in the modern age have become so top-down and centralized, right, and we took this, so we adopted this top-down centralized model for our religious communities.
So true. That's
not a natural way of living and of being together. Right. What we need to do is to strengthen, is to give support to the natural relationships that exist in society. And that means, it means couples, it means parents and children, it means extended family, it means neighbors. And to strengthen those systems and then find the gaps and have ways to serve the people who are in the gaps. Like, for example, you know, we have this very strange idea where we think that giving a lecture is the solution to every problem, right? Yeah. Like if your problem is loneliness, if your problem is that you have no one to eat dinner with, or you wake up on Eid and you live alone and you go to pray Eid prayer and there's everyone's with their family and you have no one to celebrate with, your problem is not lack of knowledge, lack of information, lack of encouragement. It's lack of people in your life. It's lack of connection. And so we need to really shift our focus to connecting people and supporting people. And that can only be done with people, not with buildings, not with, you know, with all due respect, knowledge, I'm a scholar, knowledge is important.
Right.
But proportionally, what are the number of institutes and lectures and, you know, knowledge retreats that we need compared to human resources for counseling support and presence. You know, it's really about being present with people as they go through the challenges of life. We do not have enough people. I mean, many Muslims just think, they don't think of it if they have their own family. If they have their own family and circle of friends, they don't feel that absence. But we live, it's not only converts, it's not only people who are divorced or single, but we live in an incredibly mobile society. Most Americans are going to move half a dozen times at least in their life for work, for school, for all sorts of reasons. And they're going to be disconnected. You know, they're not going to be living in that neighborhood that they grew up in for the rest of their life. So who's the person and how? What are the systems for supporting them and checking in on them? It can't be, you know, just some kind of drop box. The imams of the mosque, they only have a certain amount of time. And the needs are not all in the mosque. I mean, what do you do, for example, about the for example, I had a friend, one of the places I lived, who had two severely autistic children in the home. She could never really bring them out to Islamic events because there wasn't a tolerance for, you know, the behaviors that were natural to them. She's extremely isolated at home. Why would we not have something like a visiting a chaplain corps, you know, home-based home chaplains like we have visiting nurses or home nurses who go around and visit and spend time with and even pray with people who are in their homes and can't get out to the community. And there are so many of them. It's, I mean, I think most people would be shocked if they actually undertook the effort of trying to calculate and find these kinds of people.
Right, right. And yeah, I mean, you bring up so much, but I mean, if I could just respond, like the kind of spirit, you know, the kind of spiritual bypassing, right, that you kind of mentioned, which is like, oh, you know, the cure for loneliness or depression is more knowledge, or just come and, you know, or you know, pray this or fast, you know, and that should take care of like real human needs that people have, right? And I think that the propensity to do that, I think, is informed by this, you know, by the fact that unfortunately we have people who aren't trained in in counseling and being present with people and really addressing the needs of a community, certainly, you know, in modern America, as it were, with the challenges that we confront.
Yeah, it's not only that, it's that, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for imams.
Yeah, of course.
They're overworked, underpaid, disrespected, yeah. Subject to completely arbitrary rules that change every time there's a new board election. So it really is the community's fault when they don't have, you know, when there's a mismatch here. But many, many imams, some imams really are pastoral people, and this is their gift, is connecting people. Right. Many imams of our mosque, however, really want to be scholars. So they're good at scholarship, they're good at teaching. They actually don't have the gift of pastoral care.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting because there's many of the people who have a deep gift in that are not only men, but women. You know, it seems to be something that maybe women, because in their sort of stages of life, often have to really pay very close attention to the human needs of others, that they might kind of naturally develop this gift. And here I see a wonderful opportunity for bringing in the gifts of service of Muslim women great more into our community. To bring, I've said for a long time that every Islamic center should have a female chaplain, mm-hmm. A female spiritual caregiver. That would also, not only would that bring that presence into the mosque, but also it would help with this problem we have of what Sheikh Zainab Ansari calls blurred lines. You know, we do have an issue where some of these people in charge do not know their professional boundaries. And they're crossing the line when it comes to interacting with women. So if we had female chaplains trained in the community, even in the mosque, and able to go, not just stay in the masjid or the Islamic center, but to go out to the community from that, I think that would do a great deal to prevent some of the problems that are happening, because there would be that additional professional to whom the community is accountable.
Right. And to go back to your point about, like, sort of the kind of centralization model that has been adopted by, you know, by a lot of the communities, you know, that I think not only has to do with leadership, but also has to do with the fact that, you know, that we can't have spaces beyond just the mosque or the Islamic center. And I think kind of one of the things that we're seeing of late is the development of so-called third spaces, right, that we see in our communities where, you know, that aren't sacred like mosque spaces, but at the same time are places where our community, members of our community can come together and break bread, can just, you know, share a sense of community that are outside of the mosque.
I mean, I think there's an advantage, but they're not a magic bullet, because right, they also need to be subject to the same scrutiny and oversight.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, some of these places really become, you know, there's sort of places where, again, we fall into the same trap of one person, one man, no oversight, no supervision, no accountability, or the appeal of charismatic authority.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem. I mean, I don't think it's the spaces, really. The mosques, you know, the mosques should be places where this can happen, but we can also socialize anywhere. We don't need a separate space. You could, you know, rent a table at the library, or I don't know, just hang out in a restaurant. I'm really right, talking more about the relationships. So it's the people, and wherever the people, you know, wherever they're based, it doesn't really matter. They could be home-based, but the question is not just sitting somewhere waiting for someone to come to you, but you going out to them.
Yeah.
But with accountability and supervision, because we're talking about people's vulnerability.
Yeah.
And as we know, that predators or people who are going to exploit, you know, there are always people who are going to exploit vulnerabilities, and they flourish in an environment where there isn't accountability and supervision. Yeah. So I'm less concerned about the spaces than about the relationships. Increasing the relationships, increasing the professionalization of the people who offer services, right, and but making sure that there is accountability and oversight for that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, yeah, I think it's a wonderful point. I guess then you transition out of your role at the Hartford Seminary, and now you're back in Canada. Are you focusing more on research? Still involved in some capacity with the with the AA chaplaincy program?
Well, I here, this is a new chair in Islamic studies that I took. Again, subhanAllah, I'm really blessed. I feel that God's always directing me, because I tend to be a rather careless person and completely lacking in ambition, so I never think about the next step. So literally, again, I got a phone call saying, we have this new chair, and we think you'd be good for it. Would you please come? Would you please put in an application? And so I wasn't looking to go anywhere, but I felt a certain sense of responsibility, both to my home country, to my extended family. From, you know, I'd only been a visitor for so many years. But I am so Americanized too, so it was difficult. But I'm only an hour from the border, so
right.
I'm I'm here in Canada, but I'm in the United States at least once a month, if not more. So I really am binational, I think. But I wanted to see also how Islam is being lived here. And when you live in America, it's so easy to forget that there are other countries in the world that may do things a little bit differently. And it is different here. Canada's kind of somewhere between the American and the European model. So there are some things that are much easier here when it comes to being a Muslim, and some things that are somewhat more challenging or need to be done differently. And I have a bit of an entrepreneurial personality. I like to take on new things and try to figure out some new models or methods or avenues for knowledge and learning and connection. And so I'm enjoying that, and I'm thinking deeply about what it means to be a human being in the world today, what it means to be a believer and a member of a religious community when we are in a time of great mobility with no end in sight. I mean, I think we've simply shifted into a new era in human history, not only post-national, but I would say the era of mobility. So what does that mean in terms of loyalty and of responsibility to the place where you are for that time? I used to think about this as a Canadian in America. Was I supposed to suddenly become really super excited about a flag? That wasn't my, that didn't make me excited. What did make me excited were my neighbors and the institutions and the people around me who I worked with. So I felt this deep sense of loyalty, and wherever I go, I find myself being deeply loyal to the people around me, trying to understand their customs and norms, and to find the way to continue to be myself, yet also adjust what I do to help smooth the gears of society, of just helping to create a society where people feel a sense of harmony. And so what does that mean for this idea of identity, religious identity, and national identity? So that's really what I've been working on, the idea of belonging. And my tentative conclusion is we really have to go back to the understanding that Islam is a deeply embodied religion, meaning that rather than living in our heads or some kind of ideal concept of identity, we have to focus back to where our feet are. And after all, anytime we go someplace, the first thing we have to do is figure out where we are in the world, right? Where's the direction of Mecca? Where's the Qibla? So we have to know where we are, and then we have to get water to wash ourselves. So what's our water source? It has to be pure. Do we know where we're getting our water from? So this idea of being really grounded where we are at the time, and from our body, reaching out and understanding the ethical responsibility of everything we touch, everyone we touch, everyone we impact, whether that's the trash that we throw out, or what we put on our lawns, or how we greet people on the street, whether we're making them comfortable or uncomfortable, whether we're contributing to a happy society or adding to the misery of people. I think that we need a much more natural understanding of belonging, and I think it's perfectly in accord with the Quranic message and what the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, embodied in his life, which was presence. He was so focused on where he was and who was around him and what they needed.
That's beautiful.
And I think that's a great place to leave this conversation. I think you wrapped up so much of what we were talking about in those words that you just said. So thank you for that.
Right. Dr. Mattson, I wanted to just on a personal level, you know, the your article in the study Quran, you know, sort of commend you on that, on how to read the Quran. I think it was a wonderful introduction. I often recommend it to not only other Muslims, but just my fellow non-Muslim sort of coworkers and you know, and people in the community want to learn about the Quran in general. I feel like it's a wonderful starting point for people.
Oh, I'm glad it was helpful. It's an honor to be included in that effort. It's a wonderful effort. It's a great resource. I'm looking forward to the second edition when they take my advice for some changes.
Right.
Hopefully they'll keep the essay.
It's certainly been not without controversy, but as these things go, it's kind of interesting actually. We had Professor Lombard on the show, and then, you know, who obviously we went into quite great length in terms of how the whole project came about, and then like as I mentioned earlier, the episode with Dr. Omar. Dr. Omar had nothing but wonderful praise for it. But, you know, as these things go in our community, you know, people have different reactions. But I think that, I too, like yourself, am looking forward to the next edition, see how that changes things.
Yeah, but I am using this edition for my class now, my Quran class.
Wonderful.
This is the reference, and they're finding it really helpful.
I agree, yeah.
Well, it's been great speaking with you.
Likewise. And so before we leave, where can people find you online, Dr. Mattson, your writings? I know you're on Twitter, if you don't mind sharing that. I love following you on Twitter.
Yeah, my website is ingridmattson.org. Very easy, ingridmattson.org. And I think that's my Twitter handle, too.
Okay, great. And Zeki, where can people find us and leave us feedback?
Well, you can go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/diffusecongruence, and leave us any comments there. You can also email us at diffusecongruence@gmail.com. And, of course, go to iTunes, go to Stitcher Radio, go to TuneIn Radio. Leave a comment, leave a star rating, let us know how we're doing. Let us know your thoughts on either this episode or previous ones, and we will be sure to share those on upcoming episodes. But with that, it's a good place as any to wrap things up. So on behalf of Pervez Ahmed and our guest, Dr. Ingrid Mattson, my name is Zaki Hassan. This has been Diffuse Congruence. Thank you for listening.